content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the January-February 2018 issue of Discover magazine, which featured the top 100 science stories of 2017, contains 11 brief stories from that issue. Astronomers see and hear the cosmos. For hundreds of millions of years, two city-sized stars, each outweighing our sun, circled one another in a fatal dance. They were neutron stars, the collapsed cores left behind after giant stars explode into supernovas. Then, 130 million years ago, the dance ended. Their collision was fast and violent, likely spawning a black hole, and a shudder, a gravitational wave, rippled across the fabric of spacetime. Light from the cataclysm followed seconds later. The space-time distortion and the light reached Earth together on August 17th, making astronomical history. Astronomers announced the finding October 16th. The gravitational wave first reached Italy's just-finished detector, Advanced Virgo, before stretching and squeezing the two LIGO observatories in the United States. Orbiting space telescopes and instruments on all seven continents turned to watch the cosmic collision play out in all manner of light. Radio, infrared, optical, ultraviolet, X-rays, gamma rays. It was extremely close to us, and so it was an extremely strong signal, says LIGO scientist Julian Creighton of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In 2016, LIGO, short for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, announced it had detected gravitational waves for the first time, confirming Albert Einstein's predictions in general relativity. Astronomers compared it to finally hearing the cosmos. But the real breakthroughs would come from hearing and seeing the cosmos simultaneously, or so-called multi-messenger astronomy. That's now happened. This one event produced dozens of research papers boasting thousands of scientists as co-authors. And it uncorked a jug of other scientific feats, like a new direct measurement of the expansion of our universe, and the best evidence yet that gravitons, gravity-carrying particles, have no mass, just like photons, light particles. Astronomers have even caught the collision's chemical fingerprints, revealing the creation of 10 to 100 Earths' worth of gold and other heavy elements, ending decades of debate on their cosmic origins. We've created a new field of astronomy, says Ryan Foley of the University of California, Santa Cruz, who led the optical discovery team. We've been walking around for all of humanity being able to see the universe, but not being able to hear it. Now we get both. He adds, it's even hard to predict where this field will go, but I can tell you now, it's going to be exceptional. Science under siege but surviving. For many who value science, 2017 will be remembered as the dawn of a new era. January saw the inauguration of a U.S. president who has denied climate change and filled his inner circle with anti-science activists. But the year was as much an awakening as an annus horribilis. Researchers and citizens alike, in the United States and beyond, chose to speak out at rallies, on social media, and even in the political arena. Unprecedented numbers of scientists are considering a run for office. In a year of surprises, setbacks, and signs of hope, here are some of the most memorable and consequential moments from the first several months of the new administration. January 25th. In response to a media blackout ordered for the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, entities such as the Alt-EPA and Rogue NASA, ostensibly created by frustrated federal employees, began posting climate change data and other science-based information on social media. February 17th, The Senate confirmed Scott Pruitt as head of the EPA, the same agency the former Oklahoma Attorney General and committed climate change denier had sued multiple times in attempts to weaken its regulatory reach. March 2nd, the Senate confirms former Texas Governor and climate change skeptic Rick Perry as Energy Secretary, 6 years after then-presidential candidate Perry called for the Department of Energy's elimination. March 28th, the President signs Executive Order 13783, which calls for the review and rescinding of many environmental protections. April 22nd, a crowd of roughly 100,000 gathers to March for Science in Washington, D.C. Nearly a million more individuals participate in local events in all 50 states and on every continent. April 24th, President Trump urges NASA to send a manned mission to Mars, despite his proposal to cut the space agency's budget. April 28th, the EPA removes climate change data and other information from its website. May 18th, under Ajit Pai, who was appointed chairman by Trump, the FCC votes to begin dismantling net neutrality safeguards that were put in place in 2015. The decision opens the door to internet service providers controlling which sites consumers access. May 23rd, a proposed budget released by the White House slashes funding for both the EPA and FDA by 31%. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, Department of Energy, and the National Institutes of Health would also see significant cuts. June 1st, the President announces plans to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. June 8th, following up on President Emmanuel Macron's June 1st offer to make our planet great again by welcoming American scientists, a French government website offers foreign researchers French residency and 4-year grants of up to 1.5 million euros, about $1.75 million. June 22nd, the Department of the Interior, DOI, ends endangered species protection for Yellowstone grizzlies, despite a 2-year decline in the population, paralleling other administration decisions to remove protections for wildlife. July 19th, Trump nominates Sam Clovis, who has no science background, to be the chief scientist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Clovis's nomination would be withdrawn November 2nd after his name surfaces in an ongoing probe into Russian influence on the Trump campaign. July 20th, 6 months into the administration, the president has yet to nominate candidates for a record number of key positions in science-driven government agencies, such as the CDC and EPA. August 15th, Trump signs an executive order removing requirements for federal properties to withstand increased flooding and other climate change-related challenges. August 23rd, State Department science envoy Daniel Kamen quits over the president's decision to leave the Paris Agreement and his response to a white supremacist rally in Virginia. Kamen's resignation letter includes an acrostic. The first letter of each paragraph spells impeach. August 24th, the DOI announces plans to downsize 3 national monuments, including Bears Ears in Utah, despite pleas from Native Americans, archaeologists, and paleontologists to protect culturally and scientifically significant sites. August 31st, the DOI limits most environmental impact studies to a year in length and resulting reports to no more than 150 pages. The studies previously lasted for years and could run 1,000 pages or more. September 29th, the FDA delays required revisions to nutrition labeling by up to 3 years. The updates, which would have gone into effect in 2018, include more realistic portion sizes and the amount of added sugar in a product. October 10th, the administration announces its intent to kill the Clean Power Plan, an Obama-era initiative to limit carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. October 31st, EPA head Pruitt says he will bar any scientist who receives agency grants from serving on its advisory boards. The move opens the door for industry-funded researchers to take their place. November 3rd, the White House releases a climate science special report, part of a congressionally mandated assessment. The conclusion? Human activity is the dominant cause of climate change, contradicting many administration statements. For a more complete timeline, visit discovermagazine.com/science-under-siege. Seven whole new worlds. Imagine looking up at the night sky and seeing planets looming larger than our moon. It sounds like science fiction, but astronomers discovered it could be reality for the TRAPPIST-1 system, which boasts seven Earth-sized worlds, a record. Some orbit almost as close to each other as the moon is from Earth. In May 2016, members of the Belgian TRAPPIST team announced their small telescope had turned up three potentially habitable planets orbiting a star just 40 light-years away. Then they turned to NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope to get more detail, and it revealed there were actually a whopping seven. Three orbit in the star's conservative habitable zone, the region where liquid surface water might exist. The results appeared in Nature last February. TRAPPIST-1 is a cool red dwarf, barely bigger than Jupiter in diameter, but about 84 times heavier, giving it just enough mass to ignite into a star. Such stars can have violent eruptions early on, but are extremely stable afterward. So if the planets didn't cook, life could have evolved later. And research announced in August shows TRAPPIST-1 could be as much as twice our sun's age. The short distance between worlds also means microbes could planet hop on space rocks, as described in a June study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The TRAPPIST-1 discovery officially opened a whole new chapter of space exploration, says Julian DeWitt, an MIT researcher who co-discovered the planets. Cassini is dead. Long live Cassini! In October 1997, a Titan rocket streaked across the sky and shot a spacecraft called Cassini toward Saturn. The road trip, minus roads, was long, and Cassini didn't arrive until 2004. But it stayed there till its mission ended on September 15, 2017, with a bang, and a good deal of whimpering from Earth. Early that morning, engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory sent Cassini down to meet the planet it had spent 13 years studying. The greeting was fatal for Cassini, which disintegrated as it charged through Saturn's atmosphere. It was a planned death, a self-sacrifice that meant it wouldn't crash into Saturn's moons. Scientists didn't want to contaminate those satellites, Titan and Enceladus, precisely because of what Cassini had revealed. They weren't barren balls, but ones with oceans, water, internal energy, and nutritious chemicals. The moons demonstrated that planets aren't the only habitable spots in this solar system and beyond. Cassini's gaze at Saturn also revealed more about the formation of giant planets and regular solar systems. By studying those rings up close and personal, you could draw analogies to how solar systems might form and evolve, says Scott G. Edgington, Cassini's deputy project scientist. There will be generations of scientists who get their PhDs and do research with Cassini data, he says. Who knows what they'll find in those zeros and ones? That's why, despite the emotional eulogies, Cassini's intellectual life will continue long after its physical death. Life beneath Enceladus's ice? Alien microbes could, in theory, feast beneath the icy surface of Saturn's moon Enceladus. In April, astronomers reported that the Cassini spacecraft had discovered a chemical brew erupting from Enceladus's oceans, the same kind that bacteria eat at Earth's hydrothermal vents. Discover talked with Hunter Waite, Cassini researcher and NASA's Program Director of Space Science and Engineering, to take us there. Question: what did we know about Enceladus before Cassini? Answer: we knew nothing. We didn't know anything about the vents. We didn't know anything about the global ocean. We knew it was a small icy moon in the Saturn system, but the Saturn system is full of small icy moons. Question: what would it be like flying along with Cassini over Enceladus? Answer: the action happens pretty fast because you're traveling at 7 or 8 kilometers per second, and Enceladus is pretty small. It's like the size of Arizona. You're getting pummeled by these little ice grains. As you're flying over, you'll see these geological features, these scars, little channels, basically, what we call the tiger stripes. Within those tiger stripes are the vents, straight from the global ocean. And above the surface of the ocean, a splash comes up. You can imagine a splash from a wave that will instantly freeze. That's what creates these grains. These have information about the salt content of the ocean and some of the organics that are present there. Question: how close did Cassini get? Answer: we went really close. It was about 50 kilometers, the closest flyby over the tiger stripes. We could look at the chemical balance and determine that the hydrogen we saw was sufficient to provide food for microbes. The obvious message is, let's go back and try to find life. Question: at this point, would you be surprised if we didn't find life on Enceladus? Answer: I would be a bit surprised, yes. But I would be happy to find the answer one way or the other, because I think both, whether you find it or not, will lead to a better understanding of how life arose on Earth and what it really means. Clock ticking on superbugs. For years, United States public health officials have watched nervously as drug-resistant superbugs marched around the world, killing hundreds of thousands of people. Then in January, a report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention revealed that an elderly Nevada woman had died of a bacterial infection that defied even the biggest guns in the infection-fighting arsenal. That's when many U.S. experts sounded the alarm. Time is running out to stop these deadly pathogens. We are somewhere between total panic and a situation we feel confident we can manage, says James Johnson, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Minnesota. Already, superbugs claim 23,000 American lives every year, and over the past 8 years, the number of hospitalized children who are resistant to antibiotics has increased sevenfold. Globally, the situation is much worse. More than 700,000 die annually from drug-resistant infections, particularly in parts of Europe, Asia, and South Asia. These regions have inadequate sanitary conditions that create breeding grounds for lethal pathogens. The Nevada woman picked up her fatal bug in India. Some experts warn that new strains of drug-resistant bacteria, caused by years of antibiotic use in humans and livestock, are as concerning as Zika and Ebola. The World Health Organization identified a dozen groups of bacteria that pose the greatest threat. It could get just as bad in the U.S., warns Johnson. Infected international travelers can accelerate the superbug spread, and domestically there is a large population vulnerable to infection, the frail elderly and people who have compromised immune systems. If antibiotics become less effective, even routine procedures like appendectomies and C-sections could be perilous and could cause up to 6,300 deaths per year. Still, the U.S. situation has improved, mainly because of more vigilance and better infection control techniques in hospitals, where drug-resistant bacteria can be endemic, says John Quayle, an infectious disease specialist at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. We're doing a better job because people are scared enough now. Some promising antibiotics are in development and should be available soon, but none is considered the magic bullet. In the meantime, Johnson says, we need to find ways to get docs to be better stewards of antibiotics. Pig cells that won't go retro. More than 100,000 Americans need an organ transplant, and roughly 20 die daily while waiting. Since the early 20th century, scientists have envisioned a workaround in which we could use pig organs, but those so-called xenotransplants have never been human compatible. This year, bioengineers at Harvard University and technology startup eGenesis reached an important milestone in making that vision reality. Pigs carry retroviruses, which replicate by permanently inserting their genes into the DNA of a host species. And in lab experiments, these porcine endogenous retroviruses, PERVs, tend to leap from pig to human cells. In a paper published in August in Science, scientists address this potential biohazard by knocking out the retroviral DNA with the gene editing technology CRISPR-Cas9. After cloning PERV-free embryos, the team implanted them in sows and raised piglets. The little oinkers were completely retrovirus-free. Now, the team is adapting the technique to make other essential genetic modifications, such as knocking out molecules that trigger immune systems to reject organs. We are working on building a pig 2.0 with advanced immune capability, says Luan Yang, eGenesis's co-founder and chief scientific officer. Humanized with a hand from CRISPR, their organs could match our needs. Making blood cells in the laboratory. Scientists have taken a major step forward toward making artificial blood by creating blood stem cells in the lab. In two studies reported in Nature in May, teams at Harvard University and Weill Cornell Medicine at Cornell University created hematopoietic stem cells, HSCs. These mature into blood's essential components, platelets, white blood cells, and red blood cells. HSCs also generate a lifetime of blood cells, which must be continually replenished. When the body fails to restock, life-threatening forms of anemia, lethal infections, or serious bleeding disorders can emerge. To make the HSCs, the Harvard group used human skin cells to create induced pluripotent stem cells, iPSCs. Adult cells researchers genetically reprogram to an embryonic stem cell state, where they can grow into any kind of cell. Adding 7 transcription factors, proteins that switch on genes, the team then converted the iPSCs into immature HSC-like cells. The Weill Cornell researchers' process was more direct. 4 transcription factors prompted adult mouse endothelial cells, which line the inside of blood vessels, to turn into HSCs. Either approach could produce enough HSCs to transplant and, pending further safety testing, potentially treat leukemia, sickle cell disease, and other severe blood disorders. Says George Daly, a stem cell biologist who led the Harvard study, "It's a real scientific advance and brings us closer to making customized cells we can transplant without worrying about rejection." Unraveling mummies' genetic secrets. Despite what Jurassic Park told you, DNA doesn't last forever. Even though mummies can preserve human tissues for millennia, most useful DNA doesn't make it. That's why it was a pleasant surprise when archaeologists announced in May they'd found 3 full genomes from Egyptian mummies. Initial analyses are already suggesting that ancient Egyptians had much more Middle Eastern ancestry than Egyptians do today, and more insights likely await. Working with 151 mummies recovered from a large burial site near Cairo, German researchers sampled bones, teeth, and soft tissue to sift out any viable DNA sequences. In all, they recovered 90 mitochondrial sequences, the tiny portion of our genome contained within mitochondria, in addition to the 3 full genomes as detailed in a paper in Nature. The mummies were buried between 1400 BC and AD 400, a span covering ancient Egypt's New Kingdom and Roman period. The entire genetic library comprises the most reliable data set from the area to date, and makes a case for the viability of DNA sequencing in Egyptian archaeology. When probiotics really do work. Probiotics seem like a good idea. Use products that contain beneficial bacteria to fortify our immune systems. But most studies, especially larger ones, had not shown that they actually do much good. Now, there's some proof. In a clinical trial in rural India involving more than 4,500 newborns, a U.S.-led team and a team from the Asian Institute of Public Health gave half the babies a specially formulated probiotic concoction, while the remainder got a placebo. The team found the treated infants had a significantly lower risk of developing sepsis, a life-threatening infection that kills 600,000 newborns globally each year. Only 5.4% of babies given the concoction got sepsis, compared with 9% who received a placebo, according to the study published in August in Nature. What made this study different is, rather than using off-the-shelf probiotics that can't gain a foothold in the gut, researchers tested over 280 probiotic strains to find the right one. Their product contained a form of Lactobacillus plantarum, bacteria that can colonize cells in the intestines, preventing the bad bugs from doing the same. Hopefully, we'll figure out how the bacteria modulate newborns' immune systems, says Pinaki Panigrahi, an epidemiologist who led the team. Because if we can give this to them early enough, it should protect against disease. The Sleepless Seven: First Genes Linked to Insomnia. Lack of sleep hurts people's concentration, mood, and health. And for those with insomnia, defined as 3 sleep-deprived nights a week for at least 3 months, life can become a nightmare. The cause of insomnia, which affects 10% of the population, has long been considered psychological. But a June paper in Nature Genetics identified, for the first time, a genetic risk for the condition. A team of international researchers looked for genomic variations between insomniacs and sound sleepers among 113,000 people in the UK and found 7 genes linked to insomnia. One of the genes had been identified as a risk factor for 2 sleep disorders, restless leg syndrome and periodic limb movement. Individuals with the insomnia-linked genes also appeared predisposed to depression, obesity, and cardiovascular diseases. Exploring what these genes actually do and why they make people vulnerable for insomnia is the next step, says study co-author Yousfen Sommeren, head of the Sleep and Cognition Group at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. The research could lead to developing more effective drugs to treat the condition, he says. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.